Ahead of this episode, I'd just like to add a content note for mention of domestic violence in the section where I speak to Naomi Alderman. Thanks very much. Hello, friends, and welcome to Hello Friend. Episode 3, in which I spoke to Alice Slater about books, was so popular that I figured what the world probably needed was more audio content of smart women talking about books. So here's a special episode on that very theme. The Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction is the UK's most prestigious annual book award for fiction written by women. I have the great pleasure of presenting you with this Hello Friend special, in which I talk to a few of this year's Bailey's Prize shortlisted authors ahead of the 2017 awards. I hope you enjoy.
My name is Madeline Tien, and the book is Do Not Say We Have Nothing.
Great. And can you describe your book to me in one sentence? Possibly not, but try.
I can. It's about revolution, art, music, and friendship in revolutionary China in the 20th century.
Thank you. So Do Not Say We Have Nothing is incredibly dense and rich with detail. What kind of planning and preparation did it take to write it?
I'd say the preparation was being prepared to fling myself through a door. I think I'd been thinking about the events, the 1989 events that the book deals with, the 1989 Tiananmen demonstrations, for a long time, and thinking that one day in the future I would write about it, and then the moment came sort of unexpectedly. But I didn't know where it was going to lead. So I think in some ways the preparation really was just a kind of letting go and realizing that I didn't know everything I needed to know yet, but I needed to start writing to see what the story actually was.
Yeah.
And then filling in around it.
Great. So something I liked about this book was a kind of refusal to pander to a reader who, like me, knows little about Chinese history. Was that intentional?
It wasn't intentional. I think it just, in a way, I was thinking a lot that it's a very complex history, and there's a lot of political campaigns, a lot of details, there's a lot of names, all of those things. But I wanted it to feel like this immersion, we start with a little girl, 10 years old. We can all relate to this child, you know, and then a stranger arrives in her house, and this is the opening to levels of stories that become more and more intricate. But for the reader, we're going with the 10-year-old girl, you know, so we may know very little, just like she knows very little, but because she's our guide and she's the one in the end who's compiling this record, it will fill in around us. Like at first the world might seem very unclear and very blurry and very distant, but she's adding the pieces that will help us go from one layer to the next.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's entirely true. This sounds like probably like a strange question, but what is your favorite thing about your book?
Oh, that's such a great question. No one's asked me that. My favorite thing about this book. My favorite, I think it was the experience that it gave me.
The act of writing it.
The act of writing it, and the act of discovering so much along the way, and because of those generations of characters, you know, everyone from Wen the Dreamer to Big Mother Knife, and then to Julie and Ai Ming, I felt like I lived all their lives. So it was that strange thing of here I am in my 42, 43 years, but I felt like I suddenly lived another 80 years, you know, and I think that was the thing I loved most about it. It gave me more living in a very short space of time.
That's such a wonderful answer. Thank you. Do you have any writing rituals?
Coffee.
That's a good ritual.
Yeah.
A relatable ritual.
Yes. And
final question, what are you reading right now?
I just finished reading a biography of the daughter of Stalin. It's
cool.
Called Stalin's Daughter by Rosemary Sullivan. Really extraordinary book. Again, like this, you just enter this person, this very complicated, heavy life that was trying to find its way in the world with this burden.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for talking to me.
It's a pleasure, Bethany.
I'm Linda Grant. My novel is The Dark Circle.
And can you describe The Dark Circle to me in one sentence?
It's set in a TB clinic in 1950, which doesn't sound very promising, does it?
It doesn't. It doesn't sound promising, and yet it is the most wonderful book. I adored this book. What I'd like to know is, what was the origin of this book? I read it and I was completely in awe of the incredibly specific world that it's set in, but where did that interest come from?
Well, I met a woman who's now 87. She's actually a neighbour, and she had been diagnosed with TB at her university medical in 1949. She came from a lower middle class background in Birmingham, and had been sent to a sanatorium, and she explained to me that the NHS was only 2 years old, and she'd arrived at this sanatorium, which previously had had these very long-stay private patients, and suddenly people from all walks of life were coming into this completely enclosed environment, and there was a cure. The cure existed. It was just about getting the government, if the government had the money to pay for it, and whether they could survive long enough in order to get the cure. And I thought, that's a novel.
Yeah.
So it wasn't so much the TB that interested me, but it was the idea of having an enclosed environment in which all kinds of different people are thrown in proximity to each other, and they are trying to rebel against the system. So I wasn't really thinking of Thomas Mann's The Magic Mountain. I was more thinking of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah.
It's about rebellion to authority, and also the love between a brother and sister, because the two unlikely inmates are a pair of Jewish twins from the East End of London, girl and a boy, and he's a spiv, she's a florist, and they go into a world they know nothing about and which knows nothing about them.
Yes, that's exactly what happens. The book also really appealed to me because amid all of the kind of horrible grey misery, it's set at a time when there's a kind of newness and hopefulness. There's great clothes, oral sex, television. It couldn't really have been set at any other time, could it? I mean, it's not. The time is almost as intrinsic to the story as the location.
That's absolutely correct. The timing is critical because it's 1950, and a lot of new stuff is happening. A lot of new stuff. So the NHS has just created. It's, you know, the beginning of what was considered to be the new Elizabethan age. London is being rebuilt after the Blitz. There's a lot of opportunity out there. It's the birth of television. There's a lot of things going on in the outside world that most of these characters really, particularly the young, really, really want to be part of. And they're trapped. They're asking themselves, can I be part of the new world? Or am I doomed and fated to be part of the old world and I can't escape from it? So that is very much one of the themes of the book.
Thank you. Can you finish the sentence, I couldn't have written this book without?
I couldn't have written this book without the inspiration of Margaret Morris, the woman who I interviewed, because without her casting light on the experience of being there, and her own feelings about being there, I wouldn't have understood that there was a novel to be written about it.
Yeah, I would never have thought of this as a world that existed, let alone a world that existed with so many kind of conflicting emotions and experiences and people.
I think one extraordinary thing that I have learned is so many people, including reviewers, but people who have written to me, people at book festivals have said, my mother, my father, my uncle, my aunt, my grandfather, my grandmother had TB. It was endemic. You know, really, if you went back 60 years, you wouldn't find a family which didn't have TB in it.
It's just extraordinary.
Yeah. And forgotten, a forgotten illness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As it rightly should be. And it's just terrifying that we're on the point where something like that could come back.
Yeah.
What book have you reread the most in your life?
I have probably reread the most a series of children's books called the Sadler's Wells books by a woman called Lorna Hill. And they were the books of my childhood. A few years ago, I bought them from ABE.com in hardback originals. And they were about girls who wanted careers in the arts. You know, they wanted to be prima ballerinas, or they wanted to be show jumpers, or they wanted to be conductors. And I absolutely loved them because they were kind of very middle class, set in Northumberland or in rather glamorous flats in London. And I probably reread those books every two or three years because I think children's books can be very potent.
Yeah.
Yeah,
entirely.
I'm sure there must be something else that I'm... I will give you another one. Anita Bruckner's Hotel du Lac.
Okay, I've never read that, and I feel like I should.
Yes, you should.
Great, yeah. I will.
Genius.
Maybe I'll buy it right here in foils.
Genius.
So you are obviously very far into a very industrious and illustrious career, and I'm sure no one gives you advice. I'm sure no one gives you writing advice anymore, but what is the best piece of writing advice you ever received?
It is the best piece of writing advice is what launched my first novel when I was having lunch with somebody who was moaning about her soon-to-be ex-husband who was supposed to be writing a book but wasn't doing it. And she said, what he doesn't understand is that you just have to get on with it.
Yep.
And I had always waited for the muse. I always thought, I'm not ready. I'll know when I'm ready.
God will call me.
God will call me. I will be called to write a book. And I went home, I turned on my computer, and I thought, I'm going to start. And I wrote the first few pages of my first novel on that day.
It's all just about getting the words on the page.
It is about getting the words on the page. It's about doing it. I mean, that doesn't mean the end result will be any good.
But there will be no good or bad end result without starting.
I once heard a woman say to me at a reading, I'd have loved to have written a book. And what she meant was, I would love to see my book in a bookshop, I'd love to be doing a reading, I'd love to be doing a signing. But if you ask any writer what it is they like doing, it's the writing.
Getting the words on
the
page.
It's doing the writing. And when I'm writing is when I'm happiest.
That is great. Thank you so much for speaking to me.
Pleasure.
My name is Ayobami Adebayo, and my book is Stay With Me.
And would you be able to describe your book to me in one sentence?
Stay With Me is a novel about a marriage that's falling apart and how we can be lonely even in the most intimate of situations.
That sounds like a perfect description of your novel. It's an intensely painful book to read. What was it like to write?
It was excruciating to write. There's some chapters in it that I remember where I was writing it and what I was doing and even what I was wearing, because it was so intense and painful to write, because with Yejide in particular, I had to inhabit her character and experience everything she was going through with her. So it was painful and depressing.
Yeah. It's a really rewarding book to read, even if it is painful and depressing. But I feel like people talk a lot about how it's not important that characters are likable, more that you understand them. And I've never understood that more than I have with Stay With Me. Where did the characters come from and how much did they change over the process of writing it?
So I wish I knew where they came from so that I can go there and find more characters. But they felt to me like people who were existing and just introduced themselves to me. So as I worked on the novel, I don't think they changed very much. I just got to understand them better and discover aspects of them that I didn't know when I started working on it, such that even now, after I've finished working on it, I haven't written anything, Stay With Me, for over a year now. I feel that they're continuing their lives and I'm just not paying attention anymore.
Yeah.
I know that's bizarre, but that's how it feels.
Yeah, no, I can really believe that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it felt like the story of the book didn't end when the book ended.
Mm.
I guess because so much of it happens behind closed doors that you know that the story's happening anyway.
Yeah.
What book do you keep rereading in your life? Is there a book you keep coming back to?
Yes, Toni Morrison's Beloved.
Can't read it too many times.
Yes, it's brilliant.
What is the best piece of writing advice you ever received?
It's going to take a moment. I've received so many good ones. But I think the best one that I've ever gotten is to rewrite. I think it's the one that has been most useful for me. I think because of my process, I have to write it over and over again to understand what it is. And that's, so that's the best one for me.
Great. And finally, are there any Nigerian authors you would like to give a shout out to that people listening might enjoy their work and not have heard of?
Yes. There's a lot, but I'll start with Leslie Nneka Arima, who has a short story collection coming out in the UK in August, I think. She's a very exciting writer. I absolutely love her work. I think it's a really good collection. I think people should pick it up. There's also another short story collection, Love is Power, or something like that, by Igoni Barrett. That's also very, very good. If you haven't read The Fisherman by Chigozie Obioma, I'd recommend picking it up.
Great. Thank you so much. Thanks for talking to me.
Hello, I'm Naomi Alderman, and my novel is called The Power. It's a novel about what happens when, all of a sudden, almost all the women in the world develop the power to electrocute people at will.
Well, I was going to ask you to describe your book to me in one sentence, and now I don't even have to, so thank you so much. The book is so intensely about gender. Have you noticed a discrepancy in how people of different genders respond to it?
I have, yes. Men are terrified. they're really unhappy. Like, a couple of male friends who read it were sort of horrified in a, do you want to do these things? What's going on? And I had to sort of talk to them about it and go, no, I'm not writing this as a proposal.
Yeah, this isn't like a vision of my ideal future.
The ideal way in which men and women should behave towards each other is. But I think it feels really different to understand that those things happen to women and then to imagine it happening to you.
Yep.
So women, it mostly, like, there have been a few exceptions. Women have mostly got it and first of all feel empowered and then start to go, oh, and this is where why all that asshole shit happens. You know, that I had a friend who texted me as she was reading it. She said, why is this book making me feel so horny? And I said, it's because if you were not afraid all the time that if you smiled at the wrong person on the tube, you could get sexually assaulted, then you would feel more horny all the time.
You could, like, actually embrace all of the feelings that you experience rather than being scared of them or where they could lead.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. We learn that from such a young age. That, you know, as a woman, you're not allowed to feel those feelings. And women get it and women go, oh, yeah, I feel really empowered. And then they start to go, oh, yeah, I feel amazing. Oh, yeah, I really would definitely hurt those guys in Moldova. Then I definitely would hurt these other people. Oh, now I seem to have agreed to, like, hurt a bunch of people.
Yeah.
Huh.
The Moldova angle is in the book. This isn't just like Naomi generally
Although,
has
to be
beef
fair,
with Moldova.
To be fair, Moldova is a sex trafficking capital of the world. And if I could electrocute all the fuckers involved in that, I would.
And no wonder that you want to imagine a world where they can reverse that experience. And
if I could go and give them the power to electrocute people, I would do it. All I can do is write about it.
But indeed.
Yeah.
So on that kind of note, it's obviously a kind of flipped version of the world that we live in, but with a very specific kind of body sci-fi element. How difficult was it for you to figure out how everything works? Did you have a very clear idea of how the power works? And
so at the start, I wanted it to be something that would cause pain. I was very clear about this from, so because I'm thinking about, you know, what is the particular advantage that men get from performing acts of violence, or from having the capacity on average to perform acts of violence more on average than women. By the way, as an aside, the current beauty standard in the world, like, what is that if it is not to ensure that more men can throw more women across the room, right? Like, the situation is already that men have greater upper body strength, they tend to be taller, they tend to be broader, and so more of them on average can throw women across the room. And, like, the current beauty standard is men are supposed to be as muscular as possible and women are supposed to be as small as possible. And, like, what is that? Other than to go, no, we really like that idea that more men can chuck a woman across. And we want the maximum number. That's what we think is really sexy. It's, like, the maximum number of men can get a woman by the throat and really throw her against a wall. So I thought about what is the specifics of violence and the ability to cause pain? Because, of course, you know, upper body strength can also be used to climb mountains and to chop down trees, and there's a lot of sort of, you know, Evo psych or, oh, when we were on the savannah conversation about, well, men are in charge because they had the most strength to go and hunt the deer or whatever it might be. And I thought, okay, but I think there's something specifically about pain and fear of pain. So I didn't want to give women huge, enormous muscles. I thought that would just seem like a weird comic book character. You know, much as I love She-Hulk, I just feel like imagining all the women like that somehow is comedy. So I wanted to find something that had almost no practical use. The nice thing about electricity is it, you know, actually you probably can't power things from it. There's a few little things, but mostly there's almost no practical use. For a while, I thought of doing some sort of eldritch force, which would just cause people to be in pain. But this also just seemed, I don't know, I wanted it to be very grounded. So the nice thing I found is electric eels, who actually evolved on the same planet as us. So their genome, you know, you could, in theory, splice something from their genome to our genome. Now we have CRISPR, we could do it tomorrow. let's do it. Let's
see what
happens.
Why the hell not?
Let's just see what happens. And that meant that I could go and really research exactly how electric eels power works and go, okay, this is a, you know, this, then you can have a body of research rather than going, well, I imagine that it would make you be able to give pain and also everything would turn black, you know, just like really home in on that. And I think now that I'm talking about it, that probably any power that can cause pain would also have some fringe benefits. So, you know, yes, you can punch someone really hard, but also you can also carry logs, and that's great. So maybe it's not wrong that there are some little fringe benefits to having electricity. Maybe that also makes it more analogous.
Yep. Yeah.
That it's something that can be spun as being, you know, useful and good and wholesome and, you know, how people ought to be.
And look, it's not like a really blatant example of, like, violence. It's not a kind of cartoonishly obvious symbol of violence.
Yeah,
it
exactly.
Could be used for good,
but
or
actually
used for kind of
neutral.
Neutral.
Yeah. could be just used for something useful. Could be just, yes. You can just power your Christmas tree lights with it.
Yes.
But is that what they choose to do?
It is not. Spoiler,
as it turns out, at least in my vision, not all women are absolutely lovely.
Not all women. Mm-hmm. Okay, complete the sentence. I couldn't have written this book without...
Oh, without having had a massive, painful breakup.
Okay, cool.
That
does fuel a lot of the best writing, in my opinion.
Yeah, I'm just going to say, your breakup is like... the splitting of the atom, a lot of energy is released. It's very explosive and painful, but also there's a lot of energy there. And I really feel like I had a really bad breakup about 5 or 6 years ago, like really, really bad. It just made me so angry and sad. And I would be waking up every morning crying, you know, for about a year, woke up every morning crying. It was in that state that I got onto a tube train and I saw a photo, like a poster advertising a movie, which said, which was the picture of a beautiful woman beautifully, sexily crying. And this broke me. I thought, oh, this is the culture that I live in telling me that my tears are great and sexy and nice. And it was that started the train of thought about what would I'm allowed to swear, right?
Yeah.
What would I fucking have to do? What would I have to change for me to get onto a tube train and see a photo of a beautiful, sexy man crying?
Yeah.
Which, a lot of us find that a little bit attractive, but, you know, because we like men who can be emotionally vulnerable. But, like, the whole culture going, yes, your pain is excellent. That's what we like women for. We like women for their pain.
Not for their power.
No. And so that was the emotional state in which I started writing this book. And, if you're going through a horrible breakup as you're listening to this, let me tell you, there are wonders on the other side of it.
Like writing a cool book. What are you reading right now?
Oh, gosh. I put down and I've just picked up again Frances Bufford's Golden Hill, which is a treat and a delight.
I think that's on my Kindle. I think I should get around to that.
It is both a really fine historical novel and also really exciting. Can I tell you something about it?
Yeah.
So there is, it's set in New York before the American Revolution. So like early New York, when New York is really
New Amsterdam.
It's a provincial little village, basically. It's just after the British have taken over. And there is a man arrives on a ship from England. He has a very, very large bill to cash at a local merchant for a huge sum of money, and everyone goes, well, what is he? Who is he? And then we sometimes are in his head, and we see that he is trying to pull some trick off, but we don't know what it is.
Wonderful.
And we don't know if he's going to succeed.
Yes. I'm excited about this already.
Yeah, so
and final
enjoy.
Question, what's the best piece of writing advice you ever got?
Oh, God, best piece of writing advice. Well, there have been many. I would advise everybody to read Anne Lamott's Bird by Bird, where she talks about just keeping on. It will often seem awful. One of the best things, actually, is there's an Aaron Sorkin line from The West Wing where he talks about, it's the president talking to one of his aides who's about to run for Congress, and he says, run towards yourself, he says. When you get there, you will feel a bit nauseous because you're not used to being there. You're used to working with other people's work. And this, if you study literature, you're used to working with other people's words. When you go towards yourself, your own writing will disgust you. You've got to keep on going.
Well, thank you. That is a great answer. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Lovely to talk to you.
I hope you enjoyed this special episode of Hello Friend, in which I talked to the Bailey's Prize nominees. Tweet me at HelloFriend_pod to let me know if you've read any of the books or the books, if you had some particular favourites, and I'm always happy to hear about book chat. See you on Thursday when I return to my normal programming. Bye.